Hey, this is Mark Goldberg with the UN Affairs blog, UN Dispatch. I'm very happy today to be talking with Ambassador James Dobbins, who has served in numerous positions in the U.S. government and is currently with the RAND Corporation. We're going to be talking today about the ambassador's new book, which I'm holding up in front of the camera right now, After the Taliban, Nation Building in Afghanistan. And Ambassador, you had a ground's eye view of nation building in Afghanistan.
That's right. I was assigned shortly after 9/11 to be the administration's envoy initially to the Afghan opposition while we were in the process of overthrowing the Taliban. And then after the fall of Kabul, I was the lead person in the administration in helping to put together a successor regime and then working with that regime to try to promote the reconstruction of the country.
And your book is you've literally written the book on nation building for uninitiated readers. Ambassador Dobbins has written numerous books and academic texts on nation building, historic examples of nation building, how it's failed, how it succeeded. But this book is more of a personal memoir of what the ambassador saw on the ground. And as he was trying to support the successor regime to the Taliban. And there are some actually very interesting, I think, stories come through in this book. And one thing that jumps out to me, and I'll jump right in because we don't have much time, is the degree to which the United States and Iran were able to work cooperatively in the Bonn Conference, which you might be able to explain, to help build a successor regime. And I was wondering if you might be able to share with us, I guess, some anecdotes and stories about how that manifested itself.
Sure. I became convinced shortly after taking the assignment that we weren't going to be able to bring the various Afghan factions together and form a broadly representative government unless we had the cooperation of neighboring states. Afghanistan had been a battlefield in a proxy conflict between a number of states, between Russia or then the Soviet Union and the United States, but also between India, Iran, Pakistan, and then Russia over the last 20 or 30 years. I was convinced that we weren't going to end this civil war and bring these factions together unless the Afghan leadership were getting convergent signals from their foreign sponsors. And so I persuaded the United Nations, who was hosting a conference of all of the factions except the Taliban, to invite these governments, as well as the United States, to the conference along with the Afghans, so that we could work together to try to promote a positive outcome. And in the course of those discussions, we did succeed in forming a broad international consensus on the outcome, and then using our influence to promote that among the Afghan leadership who were represented. And the Iranians were turned out to be particularly helpful in that regard. Early on during the conference, it was the Iranians who first suggested that the final document of the conference, which was going to serve as an interim constitution for Afghanistan, really needed to make some mention of democracy and free elections, which the earlier draft hadn't contained. So that was, interestingly, an Iranian proposal. And Iran also, early on, suggested the document should also mention international terrorism and commit the new Afghan government to cooperate with the international community against terrorism.
And this sort of seems a little, I guess counterintuitive, but they sort of had an interest, correct, in seeing a stable Afghanistan, I imagine.
They had several interests. The Taliban were historic rivals and antagonists as regards the Iranian regime. Iran had almost come to war with Afghanistan under the Taliban when several Iranian diplomats had been murdered. Iran was a major transit route for the drugs that were being produced in Afghanistan, and was losing hundreds of border police to drug traffickers every year, and their own population was being increasingly affected by this drug trafficking. And finally, Iran had about 2 million Afghan refugees who were being given sanctuary in Iran at some cost to Iran, and Iran was anxious to enable these refugees to go home. So it had a number of ideological, humanitarian, law enforcement, and geopolitical reasons to cooperate with the United States. Our interests were very close at that time with respect to Afghanistan.
And just to be clear, you as the American representative at the Bonn conference, you were permitted to talk face-to-face with the Iranian representatives there?
I made clear to Washington that I thought that it was going to be essential that I have the ability to work with all of the foreign governments that were going to be represented at the meeting, and that that would include Iran, and I was told that there was no objection to my so doing.
And that was late 2001, but what presumably there would be objections these days. I'm wondering, why was this cooperation with Iran not sustained?
It's hard to answer that question definitively. The Iranians continued to cooperate throughout the meeting in Bonn. For instance, in the closing hours, there was still one very important issue that had not been resolved. The German chancellor was supposed to arrive at 9 in the morning to officiate at the conclusion of the conference, and about 2 in the morning, I was told by the UN chair of the conference that it looked like there wasn't going to be an agreement because the Northern Alliance, which was the largest and most important of the factions there, were insisting on having too great a proportion of the resultant Afghan government, and the other Afghan leaders would not be prepared to agree to that. And so I proposed getting together the main international participants in the conference, the Iranian ambassador, the Indian, the Russian, myself, the German representative, who was the host of the meeting, and the UN chair, and see whether we could collectively persuade the Northern Alliance delegate to moderate his demands and accept a larger proportion of ministries would go to representatives of other factions. We spent almost 2 hours without making any progress on this issue until the Iranian representative took the Northern Alliance delegate aside, spoke to him no more than 30 seconds privately, and when the Northern Alliance delegate came back to the table, he was ready to make the necessary concessions so that the conference could end with a positive outcome. And so Iran really did broker the concluding compromise that allowed the conference to proceed. I reported this, of course, to Washington, but I don't think that there was an adequate appreciation of how important the Iranian help had been. Or if there was, then there were other considerations which led President Bush, only a few weeks later, in his State of the Union message, to include Iran in what he dubbed the axis of evil and to threaten military action if the three countries involved, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, did not halt their nuclear programs.
And how long after this meeting, the conclusion of the Bonn conference, which I guess you argue and just said was concluded thanks in large part to Iranian sort of last-minute intervention, how long after the Bonn conference was the axis of evil speech?
I believe it came about 3 weeks later.
Interesting. I guess, sticking to the Bonn conference, how did you guys settle on Karzai, Hamid Karzai, as sort of the go-to de facto leader of post-Taliban Afghanistan?
Well, it was clear that the leader would probably need to be somebody of Pashtun ethnicity, since that was the largest single ethnic and linguistic group in Afghanistan. It was clear that it probably couldn't be somebody from the Northern Alliance, which was the most powerful faction, but one that represented largely the Tajik and Uzbek and the Shia minorities in the country rather than the Pashtun majority. And there were a number of claimants to the office, but Karzai was the one who had the broadest appeal, and he had particularly impressed a number of foreign governments. He had been a spokesperson for the opposition to the Taliban. He had spent a good deal of time traveling to Washington, to Moscow, to Tehran, to New Delhi, seeking support for the opposition to the Taliban. And I found it remarkable the degree to which he had positively impressed a number of governments that otherwise agreed on almost nothing. The first person who suggested to me that Karzai might be an acceptable candidate was the head of the Pakistani intelligence service, which had been the main supporters of the Taliban. So that was an interesting data point. And then the next person who suggested Karzai to me was the foreign minister of the Northern Alliance. Now, the Northern Alliance and the Pakistani government had been at loggerheads, had been fighting each other for most of a decade. And so if they both thought that this was a candidate they could live with and an acceptable choice to lead the new Afghan government, then he clearly had exceptional diplomatic and interpersonal skills to impress people with his qualities as disparate as those. Later, I heard the same thing from the Russian ambassador, from the Indian ambassador, from the Turkish representative, and it was increasingly clear that this was a person who had extraordinary interpersonal and diplomatic skills and had gained the confidence of a number of different governments. And I think he'd had a similar experience with respect to many of the Afghan leaders.
I recall after the Bonn Conference, where there was a sense of guarded optimism about Afghanistan's future. Today, I'd be hard-pressed to say that there is much optimism, guarded or not. I'm wondering, what factors have led to sort of the renewal of what essentially seems to be a civil war in Afghanistan today?
I think there are a couple of factors. One was the failure of the United States and the rest of the international community, but particularly the United States, to take advantage of the lull that came with the fall of the Taliban, the installation of the Karzai government. During 2002, 2003, the country was basically peaceful, and there was an opportunity to extend security to the population, deploy peacekeepers in the major cities in the country, and begin a reconstruction process. The U.S. chose not to do that. It chose not to deploy international peacekeepers outside of Kabul. It chose not to assign U.S. forces any peacekeeping mission. And it provided very limited assistance to Pakistan. And the result was that we lost a couple of vital years during which the Taliban was able to regroup, reorganize, and again begin to pose a threat. So that was one factor. The second factor was that we essentially allowed the coalition of neighboring states that had come together at Bonn to gradually dissolve. We didn't maintain the contacts and the focus on Afghanistan that we had achieved at Bonn. This took place with respect to Iran, whose continuing cooperation on Afghanistan, which they offered even after the President's State of the Union message was rebuffed. But it also happened with respect to Pakistan. With respect to Pakistan, we focused almost entirely on efforts to track down bin Laden and the remaining al-Qaeda associates, but we did not put any pressure on the Pakistanis to interfere with the operations of the Taliban, who had fled in large numbers to Pakistan and who were reorganizing among the Pashtun populations in Pakistan and beginning to rebuild the capacity to mount an insurgency.
You know, I read recently that something like 90% of the world's poppy supply, heroin or poppy supply, comes from Afghanistan. And I'm wondering, does the presence of poppy sort of make provide maybe an endless source of revenue for would-be insurgents in Afghanistan? Is it sort of too much of a destabilizing factor that Afghanistan will never be the secure democracy that we once hoped it would be?
I think that the opium production is certainly a major destabilizing factor. It is a source of revenue for the Taliban. A great deal of the revenue goes into the hands of corrupt Afghan officials, not Taliban. So it's not that the Taliban has the monopoly on this revenue, but they certainly gain some support from it. And I think that it certainly makes the situation much more difficult. There has been some success in eradicating opium production in some parts of the country, and generally in the parts of the country that are more secure and in which other forms of economic activity can begin to take hold.